Take a network break. Spring is just around the corner. The virtual donuts are fresh from the extruder and the coffee is hot. So pull up a chair as we discuss this week's IT news. HPE is adding LLMs to Aruba. Broadcom's flexing its AI muscles. An Arista founder gets busted for insider trading and more. We're sponsored today by G-Core. G-Core has introduced FastEdge, a new product in low-latency edge computing for serverless app deployment built on WebAssembly. With FastEdge, your code runs closer to your users than ever before, leveraging a global CDN network of over 160 data centers to ensure lightning-fast performance. You can join the FastEdge beta today and transform how your applications are delivered. Visit gcore.com/packetpushers to learn more. That's gcore.com/packetpushers. We also have a sponsored Tech Bytes. After the news, we're going to talk with network as a service provider, Nile. Nile's aiming to streamline network deployment and operations by providing a complete network service. It performs the site survey, it provides switches and access points, brings the gear on-prem and deploys it, and then provides ongoing monitoring and optimization. They also integrate things like zero trust and micro-segmentation, and we'll dig into how Nile differentiates from traditional network vendors. Last but not least, if you like Network Break, we've got a bunch of other podcasts, including new shows on the feed, including Packet Protector, a security-oriented show with me and Jennifer Manella. Of course, as IPv6 Buzz, Heavy Networking, Heavy Strategy, Day 2 Cloud, Full Stack Journey, Kubernetes Unpacked, and more. It's all at packetpushers.net. All right, let's get into some news. HPE announced it's adding generative AI to its Aruba Central Management Platform. The company says it's trained multiple large language models, or LLMs, on Aruba documentation, millions of actual customer queries, and telemetry gathered by Aruba's network devices. The feature is made available in the AI search feature in Central. The goal is to let engineers and admins use natural language to ask questions and get more things like more accurate document summaries, instructions, and operational diagnoses.
Yeah, so this doesn't sound... like, obviously, everything Aruba does now lives in the shadow of the pending Juniper acquisition.
Drift. Yes, it does.
And, of course, Juniper's core value is its Mist AI, which is, I believe, going on near a decade old. To certainly, like, you know, more than 5 years of AI in networking sort of thing. I think eight? I think it could be eight.
Yeah, it's been around a while. It was sort of there before AI took over the tech industry, at least LLMs took over the tech industry.
Yeah. We were doing it when no one else was, and you just all, you know. yeah, and they definitely had a tough time convincing customers. We were all very doubtful.
Yes.
But they certainly convinced everybody. Juniper was definitely able to carry it off, albeit starting from a narrow base there around the wireless industry, and then extending it into the campus slowly and so on. And now they're extending it, obviously, everywhere because it's the topic du jour this year, really. I don't think it's going to fade out soon.
Nope.
Now, I think this is, of course, the story that most people are pitching AI as an operational enhancement. So how do we reduce the cost of operations? How do we improve operational efficiency? How do we improve service levels with what we have, right? So nobody's saying that AI is going to change the way that datagrams flow through our network. It's not going to change Ethernet frames or IP packets or, you know, whatever. It's just going to, the whole idea, the best that you can do with LLMs is, you know, do spelling checks faster. And when I say spelling check, that's exactly how image generation works. It just auto-completes, right? You say, I want auto-complete to operate in this way, and, you know, Sora AI or Stable Diffusion will go out and auto-complete an image based on what you want. And that's a rough approximation of conceptually how AI always works, right? It can work out an assumption saying, if you're building an image with this sort of a theme, this is the pixel that goes next to this pixel, this is the pixel that goes next to this pixel, and so on and so forth.
LLMs are doing the same thing with language. It's that we've looked at tons and tons of language and words and sentences, and based on statistical probability, we assume this word or part of a word is what's going to come next, and we'll anticipate it for you. Yeah.
So the vendors who sell us infrastructure see AI as a way to improve the operational efficiency. And I think this comes down to two things. A lot of executives look at this as how do we reduce the cost of operations? Or the flip side of that question without having to say cost, because vendor sales don't like talking about costs. They like to talk about values. It's a pitch. It's an, you know, humans respond better. So how do we improve operational efficiency? What's the same question, which is reduce cost. But I think really what they should be focusing on is how do we improve service levels with what we have? So how do we make, you know, networks have gotten more complex, not less. We've got overlays, underlays, things are going over the internet. We've got private WANs. Things were much simpler 5 to 10 years ago than they are now. And so we need there is an angle where you could say AI will take away the complexity of operating these in some way and bring them back into some sort of manageable form. So what I've sort of been out thinking about how do you, what's a framework that I can come up with to sort of put this together. So far, I'll give you this, Drew, right? You ready for this? This is a little bit long, so just strap yourself in, right?
Okay, I'm strapped in.
So things that there are three levels to an AI of what we have today, right? And level one is we've got a bright young woman in the back room somewhere who whipped up some code on the weekend to add and, you know, can pick your favorite LLM API to the CLI of our network device. And now you can plain language commands into your router and say, show me my BGP neighbors in tabulated form in alphabetical order, you know, or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Which is cool, right? Cool. But yeah. Not yep. structurally, you know, and maybe there's some operational efficiencies there, but no, really, no, that's not AI. That's kind of fooling around. You might as well have just developed a fancy piece of Ansible to do the same thing and you get the same results. But once you get part of that bit, you get to level two, which is, and what we're seeing now from multiple vendors. So what Aruba's done here is what other vendors have done, and we've spoken to them about this, is trained an LLM model extension on our help desk data and tech manuals and all of the forums that customers have been adding data to, you know, asking questions and
yes.
working on. So, you know, if you've been a regular contributor to a vendor forum for the last 10 years, the vendor thanks you very much.
Congratulations. In fact, they probably have helped train
an LLM. Congratulations. Yeah, you have to train an LLM. And so the idea there is that, you know, you can now ask natural questions or something like a natural question and get something better than a search query back, right? Before, you would go out and enter in a search query and you would hope to find a document that had been written by somebody, hopefully, uh-huh. maybe, uh-huh. and it would be the answer to your question. Well, now, if you can do that, then maybe the LLM can not only maybe bring you back the tech document want, because it can understand your intent behind the search query more efficiently than you can frame it, but maybe it can also do some sort of extrapolation and some reasoning to say, this tech document is what you want, but I can also put together some, you know, if you say, why is this BGP neighbor not peering? It can put together auto-generate a response and say, this is things you need to know about BGP peering, right? And
right, here's a summary of everything we found, if this helps you move along faster, yes.
Yeah, well, I think there's two sides to this. There's sort of like a 2A and a 2B here. Mm-hmm. 2A is, this is what BGP is, and if you want to know about neighbors, these are the attributes. I think 2B is when it starts to query the network for status information, mm-hmm. and it says, oh, I can see that, you know, this community that's being shared isn't correct, or there's a this peer isn't forming because the passwords aren't right, because it's got access to the configs, right?
Right.
So 2A is you've just gotten all your legacy, you know, all of that data that you've got from your help desk over the last 10 years, trained it into an AI model, strapped an LLM on the front so that you can query the data in there. 2B is when it starts going out and querying the network and sort of brings that together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, one is sort of document and knowledge base focus. The other is based on actual telemetry, state data, configs, and so on.
Yeah, it starts to put together some reasoning, right? But it's not true reasoning. It's just saying, oh, I know that if these two router configs go together, then they're not right. They're not going to peer,
yes.
right? Or you've got an access list on this interface, that packet's not going to go out there, right? Mm-hmm. That's not intelligent per se. That's just identifying well-known problems, right? And in the past, we relied on an engineer to detect that. And potentially you can now have an AI do some of that for you. Right. So there's sort of like 2A, we train to help desk, you get better queries. And then level 2B, you know, or, you know, level 2 advanced, if you want, we're starting to say, you know, I can start to do some reasoning based on very common problems. But generally in level 2, what you're lacking is a network model or a digital twin. Right. And for the AI model to really start to be intelligent, you have to have an abstraction and to be able to say, here's the model of the network that I've got. And then I'm going to set my AI and my LLM and the models that I've changed to be able to know much more. So this is where you shift up to level 3, which you've got a much more comprehensive AI trained on petabytes of stream telemetry configurations. It might have access to flow data from the live network. It's going to be cross-linked with all of the internal and external TAC data from level 2. Plus you've got a small army of developers verifying data clean, data valid, and then it's extensively consumed by users who further enhance the data set and weed out the false flags in the set, right?
Yep.
So if you sort of subscribe to that level 1, you know, use an LLM, 2, add in the existing information, 2, and strap an LLM on the front, and there's some operational advancements, to level 3, a full AI system you know, which is actually knowing the current state of the network within a few seconds. It understands configuration data. It understands state. It reads the telemetry from the network to build up a state model of the network. And, you know, approaching what we used to talk about with companies like Forward Networks and their ability to, you know, map the whole network out and to intuit various things around it, but in that sort of frame. So this to me from HP Aruba, if you accept that model and argue, you know, you can argue about it with me, is sort of a 2A. We sucked in all of our models. So for me, if I was HPE and I'm looking at turning into, you know, AI 6 to 8 months ago, Drew, or a year ago, it's a whole year now that AI has been a thing, right? Wow. I would do this project as a way to build up skills and deliver something to customers quickly. So this is a rapid prototyping iteration type thing. Mm-hmm. And they are obviously headed towards level three. But I think the only people who could claim level three AI networking, you know, or AI operations in networking today is somebody like Juniper. There's a few of the other startups as well, Selector AI and so forth, who've got a total focus on this.
Yeah.
Maybe they've got something in this type of thing, but I think this is a two-way solution. Do you agree?
I agree. Of the established networking vendors that we regularly cover, I feel like Juniper is the one who can claim level three in your definition. And yeah, I also agree that HPE's approach seems like a level two. And that's fine because it, you know, that level two can be very helpful if you've got questions and you, instead of having to search for documents, you can get it easier. I found this announcement somewhat curious because my assumption was that HPE was buying Juniper for the AI capabilities. But it does seem like it's also continuing to invest in its own homegrown AI capabilities. So it just makes me wonder about sort of the disposition of the Aruba side of the house and the Mist side of the house going forward.
Well, I think the thing to recognize here, Drew, is this would have started 6 to 8 months ago, I surmise.
Yes, probably. Yeah. I would assume
and
so.
And it was
well.
Ready to ship. So what do you do? Do you not ship it?
Right.
And I suspect this has value even after the Juniper acquisition. You know, once Juniper comes into the fold, what do you focus on first?
Right. Yeah.
And a lot of it is going to be merging the team. So this type of project, shipping it now, it's probably got it's another year before Juniper comes into the fold. I think I don't remember the closing date for the Juniper acquisition off the top of my head.
It's still a while out. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was quite a long thing.
Long run, mate.
Late calendar year 2024, early calendar year 2025. Right.
Yeah.
So still, you know, a year, let's say early 2025 is a year, right?
Yeah.
So you've got another year before Juniper comes in the fold. You've got another year as they work through building the, you know, deciding where they're going to go. Or, you know, maybe they pull a VMware and go for a hard change upfront, like make the hard decisions early and cut the product. You know, I suspect it'll be much more of an organic change. I don't think they want to alienate people.
Heck no.
They'll go with a much, yeah, different business approach. I don't. Broadcom would do that. You know, I don't think HP would do that.
No.
So, you know, this product's probably got a life of 18 months to 2 years, delivers a solution to customers now. So it's certainly not something that Cisco's got, as far as I'm aware. I don't think Cisco's talked about doing AI across its tech support in any way. Or if there is, I haven't seen any sort of information about it. So yeah, why wouldn't you ship it if you've got it and it's not, you know, hugely expensive to do this?
Yeah, so HPE says it's trained multiple LLMs. It didn't say which ones. These LLMs are hosted internally on HPE GreenLake, which means your queries aren't being sent out to a public LLM like ChatGPT, in case you were wondering. It's all internally hosted. And I am assuming GreenLake will play a larger role in whatever happens with the outcome of Mist, Juniper, and HPE down the road as well.
Yeah, you got to think that HPE GreenLake is, you know, effectively it's a combination of off-prem cloud. Mm-hmm. You can choose to have GreenLake come on-prem and install racks of servers, and they'll always have enough resource there for you to buy, you know, you just pay per consumption. But there's also an off-prem aspect to it as well. And I suspect that HPE is eating their own dog food here. They're already selling GreenLake AI. You can go and buy a GreenLake AI and get a bunch of, you know, clusters, and included in that is a bunch of software, and some of it will be NVIDIA AI and some of it will be other companies' AIs. Question there is, are they using an open source model and they just don't want to talk about it? Or are they doing something different here and saying, we've already licensed an AI LLM or an AI toolkit from somebody and we're using it and showing, you know, and we're eating our own dog food.
I think there's a lot out there. Obviously, you know, they want to show off GreenLake as a place for this to happen. And they're using multiple LLMs, so they must have licensed multiple LLMs. And again, yes, they're also developing their internal chops around AI ahead of the acquisition. My big take is that I think the Aruba side of the house and the Mist side of the house are going to be sort of siloed concerns for the next 2, 3, maybe even 4 years as all of this gets worked out.
Yeah, but I don't think Aruba can wait. I think Aruba's struggling a little bit at the moment. Like, they've still got a top-notch product and so forth. But, you know, there's lots of other companies out there. Palo Alto, Fortinet are moving into that Wi-Fi campus land space. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, SASE, SD-WAN, where Aruba's, you know, got some good products there, but I'm not sure that they're necessarily getting traction with the market like they might have hoped. HP doesn't have a strong security story, and I think the security story is, you know, really a big deal.
Yes.
When you look at the market, they're still pitching 20 to 30% growth in enterprise security for 2024, 2025. And so if you're out there selling branch networking solutions, you might be thinking like, oh, okay, I've got a problem. So I think Aruba has to do something to keep saying, we've got something for you, Mr. Customer. We've got something new and novel. And but mostly I see this as an internal project to build up AI skills. So you need an AI team somewhere inside of your networking server, you know, in your organization. And even if Juniper comes along with Mist, they can redeploy the people developing the Aruba AI to, I don't know, developing some other AI operationals thing for servers or storage or whatever.
Yes, some Uber AI that will go over all of the products in the all of the portfolio.
Yeah. Once you start here, you can turn it into managing containers with AI or whatever. So it's not a big deal. Yeah. I don't think,
All right. Well, links to the show notes. If you want to read up on it, we will move on. You may have noticed NVIDIA getting a ton of media and investor interest as AI infiltrates all aspects of our lives. Broadcom would like to remind investors that it too has an AI play. The company recently made a presentation to investors touting its own AI infrastructure portfolio. In particular, it's talking about its Jericho 3, Ramon, and Tomahawk ASICs for AI Ethernet fabrics and its Thor 2 NICs, among other things.
Yeah, so I think we mentioned this a bit last week, Drew, and then hinted that we would come back to that this week. And of course, NVIDIA had its GTC conference last week, or as Jensen Wang called it, the AI Woodstock.
Or somebody else did, but yes, it was definitely seemed like a love fest for NVIDIA.
I think, I don't know if it was, anyway, I thought it was kind of really interesting to sort of look at the pitch that Broadcom made in the same week as GTC. So notably, what Broadcom was trying to say is, well, yeah, look, you're giving all this value to AI in our share price and everything, but investors, look, you should really see us as an AI company too. Mm-hmm. And so they came out with a presentation. It's in the investors, so there's a link in the show notes if you want to see it. And I think it's interesting to look at this and see, and if you compare it to NVIDIA, you can see just how far the gap is between these two companies and the different approaches in the go-to-market. So Broadcom's go-to-market strategy in terms of networking, this is not the whole of Broadcom, but we're just talking about Broadcom networking here, is to build components of a solution and then sell them to a middleman like Dell, Cisco, Arista, right?
Yes.
And I think in a stable and steady environment, this more or less, you know, where things are predictable and static and you know, and you can predict how many wing wongs you need for the next 2 years, this is a really good way to work because it avoids all the costs and overheads of a solution. That is, you don't have to provide tech support. You don't have to hold the stock. You don't have to maintain the software. You've got less investment in product management right the way across the board. Why not let Dell, Cisco, and Arista go and do that? You know, why would Broadcom go and build a routed company or a switch company? You know, they would much rather build the guns and let Dell, Cisco, HPE, Arista fight it out, right?
Right.
So, but I think the challenge here, of course, is that AI has really disrupted the data center market, not the Wi-Fi market, not the campus market, not the SASE SDN, although that's already been, you know, pretty transformed over the last decade. I think the change here is that very large customers are spending literal billions, not marketing billions or CEO billions. You know, when a CEO says a market's worth $50 billion, they're always like exaggerating for their own purposes.
Sure.
There are, you know, we're seeing Oracle spend $2 billion on NVIDIA AI equipment. You know, Azure is rumored to be spending $5 to $10 billion in acquiring NVIDIA hardware and clusters for its AI to support the people who want to do AI in the cloud, that sort of thing, right?
Right.
And NVIDIA, of course, is capturing all of that, and Broadcom's going like, but we've got all of those things, but they're not solutions. Like NVIDIA is wrapping them up into a solution.
Yeah, I guess the way I think about it is, if we want to use this model, Broadcom is selling automobile engines, NVIDIA is selling you a car and a map and maybe even a driver and maybe some of the road. So entirely different markets.
But also, for customers who want the engine and the gearbox, they'll sell you that as well. So if you're Cisco or Dell and you want to just buy the engine and the gearbox from NVIDIA, they'll sell you that.
They can sell you that too if they want to, yes.
Yeah. So you've got all of these companies out there saying, oh, we've got AI solutions to the enterprise. You can use us. And yes, it's NVIDIA AI, but it's not at all the same. And, you know, NVIDIA in this case is so far ahead, but it's also charging It's also placing a very, you know, generous premium on the products that it's building because of their technology advantage. You know, and they can produce all the results to claim it's more efficient. You know, we can produce more AI results on the same power and so forth, right?
Right.
So that's a real transition in the market. And right now, the way I see it is Azure, AWS, Google, Oracle, you know, all of those mega clouds, they want to capture customers on their platforms for AI and lock in the revenue long term. So they're figuring that if they can get AI in, then the first wave of AI development will happen in those off-prem clouds, and those people will then be locked into those platforms going forward, which is solid, right? That's a lot of Kubernetes was done off-prem, and now people don't want to retool it to do it on-prem, and reasonably so. So I think there's a lot of motivation for these companies to go out there from a straight-up business point of view, have the AI, have a solution. They're one of the few organizations who have the money to spend on these, you know, high-priced assets at scale, and there's a lot of hype here. So while NVIDIA has a commanding lead over competitors, Broadcom held this brief. So let's talk about what Broadcom talked about. What Broadcom was trying to say is, we've got the networking components of this, and the networking components come in four parts, according to them. One is they have the NICs, which go into your servers. Uh-huh. They have PCIe switches, so that is the PCIe bus. We talked 3 weeks ago about the latest generation of the PCIe bus technology where they can actually extend it, because PCIe bus is a network. It's not just a bus. It just happens to be a bus type of network. And they're also bigging up something called an XPU. Now, as best as I can tell, an XPU is a DPU, right?
Okay.
So it's basically a very accelerated DPU. And then obviously they've got the switching architecture. But what's coming into vision here is, if you go and track what's happening at AI Ethernet, or if you track what NVIDIA is doing around its SHARP protocol or its NLCC, we talked about NLCC in last week's episode, what they're doing is starting to move networking functions into the actual switches, into the DPUs and into the switches. So that, let's say you've got 100 AI servers, you know, two racks worth of servers. Well, 100 would be, say, four racks worth of servers, let's say, for the sake of the argument. And you've got GPUs spread across those servers that need to be synchronized. Well, if you're going to do a scatter-gather operation, that's where one GPU does a calculation, comes up with results, and then you want to send that to all the other GPUs. Uh-huh. That's kind of like a multicast operation, right? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, does it make sense for that server to transmit that to the other 99 servers, or does it make sense to send that to a switch nearby and let the switch do the replication for you? Uh-huh. That is a grossly or metaphor for what's happening here. And bear with me, I'm not finished my research. I'm not confident I understand what's happening here, but I'll go with that for the time being, right? They're doing this sort of in networking approach. So I think these XPUs are going to be in the switches for a while. So they're going to be DPUs with they're going to have ARM CPUs, is going to be memory. They're going to have an operating system. It's not going to be part of the actual forwarding plane. It'll sit in there as what I always think of as a power sucking alien. What I used to refer to as router boards that we used to put into Cat 5500s 20 years ago. And they didn't actually connect to the network at all. All they did was use the chassis to provide power. Uh-huh. And then you had cables on the front that you plugged into other Ethernet ports. And they were lovingly called power sucking aliens. So these DPUs are going to be called, because they didn't integrate with the box at all, right? They didn't.
Okay.
They just used the chassis, a very expensive chassis slot, just to provide power to a box that could have been a 1RU switch, you know, device. Anyway, different time, different place. So what you're going to have is a situation where all of the AI servers will have a NIC or maybe a DPU on board. They're going to, you know, talk on the internal PCIe bus. So one of the big things about NVIDIA's announcement last week was that they're using NVLink, which is their version of PCIe bus to enhance, that they claim is bigger and better and more of whatever metaphors whatever adjectives you need. Whereas Broadcom saying, well, PCIe is good enough for most everybody. And then they're going to have these XPUs, which is sort of like the DPU then, but in a switching context. So it goes into the device in the network, and then you scale up with switching fabrics, and then you start to implement some sort of synchronous Ethernet, right? Uh-huh. Does that make sense?
It does, yes. I guess the notion of a DPU on a switch is interesting. I'd like to dig into more about what Broadcom's thinking there.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have to eat some crow here, because we did talk about this when Pensando was putting it inside of HP Aruba switches.
Right,
they
do have
much
that.
About it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I sort of went like, what? And I think I don't think this was with the intention of putting AI in. I think the idea here is that you would start to run applications in the switches. Now, in the last 35 years that I've been involved in data networking, this has been tried over and over and over, and it never, ever got legs. Uh-huh. It was always just everybody was unhappy. No one came out of that on the other side looking good. And it was just a world of unhappiness. And I've been a big proponent of keep the network dumb, fast, and stable.
Right.
But, you know, but I think as the more I read up to how AI networking is going to work, and I start to understand how the software works, like NVIDIA actually has APIs, which basically just offload stuff into the network. Uh-huh. And off it goes, right? There's these scatter-gather operations, for example, which is the only ones I really understand at this time. So, you know, if you're an AI networking expert, by all means, get in contact and we'll record a show. And you can try and explain what's going on. But apparently they really make a difference. You're talking 20% performance improvements. Uh-huh. And the new version is supposed to be even better, 40% in performance improvements, although nobody's really sure because it hasn't been published yet. So if they can get the network to start being an intelligent partner in the AI processing in the data center, then you have moved away from dumb switching, right?
Right.
Where the optics are, you know, 60-70% of the cost of a modern data center switch is in the SFP modules, not mm-hmm. the ASIC. Right. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. if you go out and buy a Jericho AI, I mean, fine chip, you know, but by the time it goes into a switch, it's the actual switch itself is 1/5 of the total cost. The rest of it is SFP modules when you actually rack it up in the switch and everything like that. So Broadcom sees this as a chance. Is this a compelling thing, Drew? Because, you know, you've got InfiniBand in here. You've got Rocky. You've got MPI, message passing information. You've got Rocky V2 for doing DMA. You've got a bunch of APIs sitting over the top of all this. It's not particularly simple or easy to understand, in my view. So Broadcom saying, well, we've got all the pieces, we've got all the chips, and you know, I would put it to you that Broadcom hasn't, you know, needs to move faster to get these chips to catch up with NVIDIA. NVIDIA is so far ahead, it's really hard to, you know, there's so much capacity for Broadcom to make a better product here, and I'm sure they're working on it. But they've also got to get Cisco, Dell, HP, Arista to start adding the software features in here. And that's the bit that's missing. So that's what I don't find compelling about the Broadcom vision.
I'll tell you what I think is happening. I think, as I said, Broadcom is seeing NVIDIA get a lot of market value out of being perceived as an AI leader. Broadcom also has an AI portfolio. Maybe it hasn't done a good job, as good a job as NVIDIA, as touting it to the market. So they are trying to change that with this investor presentation. One thing that jumped out at me is they say that they are predicting AI revenue as a percent of their semiconductor sales. They had initially predicted that would be 25% by 2024. Now they're saying it's going to be 35% by 2024, which will also be more than double than 2023. So they're saying, look, AI related sales inside Broadcom are growing. I think they also want to maybe get some bigger market cap out of this. NVIDIA now has a market cap of $2 trillion. That's compared to just over $600 billion for Broadcom. Broadcom saying, I bet that market cap could get a little higher if we start touting our AI capabilities more. And this thing I'm seeing emerging in AI fabrics built on Ethernet, something called, it's a Broadcom approach, essentially called a scheduled fabric. And you can do the scheduling either in the top of rack switch, you put the intelligence in the top of rack switch to do the scheduling, or in the endpoint itself, do the scheduling there. And they've got chips that will accommodate either of those approaches. The Jericho 3 AI is doing the intelligence for scheduled fabric in the top of rack. And if you were doing it in the device itself, then they've got their Tomahawks, which are just super fast, high buffers. So they are saying, we have a portfolio to take you either way. I think the other slight advantage Broadcom has here is this whole Ultra Ethernet consortium and essentially the entire OEM vendor market that's saying, we need to sell against NVIDIA. So Broadcom, you're our guy. We will go with you whatever you do, because we need to compete against the Mellanox side or the InfiniBand side of NVIDIA.
Right. So there's really only two vendors who can compete here, and that is Juniper with its Trio and Cisco with its Silicon One, right? Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting to see how much money they will put into these chips to turn them into AI-ready capability. Now, they're already way ahead. You know, is it worth competing with Broadcom and NVIDIA, who are, you know, Broadcom is going to be able to spread the cost of its product development across multiple vendors. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't need to do the packaging and, you know, the promotion and all that sort of stuff. So it's got a motivation to work in a certain way. Juniper, as a part of HPE, has a motivation perhaps to maintain its custom silicon. It's always believed that custom silicon is a key advantage for it in some of its markets. and it's been willing to embrace the reality, but I've never been quite convinced that they don't think that custom silicon is really where they can demonstrate most value to customers. But, you know, Mellanox doesn't have any distractions. So it doesn't do service provider routers. It doesn't do campus switches.
Right.
It doesn't have to. Do you know what I mean? Like it's
right.
Just,
it's laser focused on now building AI Ethernet fabrics. Yes.
Yes. I don't think, you know, they're still building the Spectrum and 5 switches. But if you're buying them for low latency financial transactions, which they're very popular with the high HFT people, mm-hmm. they've got to be looking at this. You know, I don't think NVIDIA even looks at that market and goes like, wow, that's interesting. I think it's sort of like, sure, you could have them. But it's not a focus. You know,
sure.
Must be a bit of a downer for some of those people.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, Mellanox was absolutely all in on HFT and, you know, supercompute. And mm-hmm. now it's like, yeah, sure.
Right.
Must be, yeah.
Lots of stuff happening here. We've got plenty of links in the show notes if you want to read up. We've got other stories to cover, so let's move on. First, Intel is prepared to suck up billions of dollars in subsidies from the U.S. federal government. The chipmaker has signed a non-binding preliminary memorandum of terms for Intel to receive up to $8.5 billion in direct funding for semiconductor projects in the U.S. Intel could also get up to $25 billion in tax credits and loans up to $11 billion.
So we actually have two stories about silicon manufacturing today, and this is the Intel one.
Yes.
And obviously this is the usual talk about, you know, until 2020, globalist politics was working. And it's hard not to look back and go like in 2020, we were so hopeful that a globalist approach, that by trading with everybody and doing global investments and, you know, moving manufacturing to China and Asia made sense. And we were watching the wealth of those companies lift as they were, you know, as those companies built up their skills and started to, and the West was able to sort of, you know, work, and it was working, right? And China was, you know, growing and its business, and it was turning over and growing, and the middle class was emerging and all that. I'm not going to get into the politics, but there was a time then where we were very hopeful that just doing business, trade and investment was going to come up with a stable, peaceful planet.
Yeah,
and
I'm going to take you back to the 1990s for that, not the 2020s. But yes, I agree that was one of the, that was some of the justification for all of this offshoring of traditional domestic manufacturing. Yes, you were getting cheaper labor, but it was also sort of rising the global wealth of the world as well that could have had positive benefits.
Yeah. And so now we're returning to what we had in the 70s and 80s, which was a much more protectionist sort of approach.
Yes.
And where national industries were protected with extensive subsidies and so forth. But I would also highlight that it's also been fairly clear that offshoring has been failing for more than a decade.
Yes.
So short-term gains were quite often turning into long-term pain. So if you outsourced your operations and just sort of dusted your hands and went, good, look at that. We had 1,000 people in, you know, in the UK making wing wongs, and we outsourced it to India, and there's 1,000 people making the same wing wong, and it's costing us half or whatever. That's it, job done.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever it was.
Yes.
And then suddenly realizing that quality is a problem and they needed 10 times as many people to get the same productivity per person and so on and so forth. So I think that, you know, offshoring is, such as it was, wasn't the glorious, don't look back at it with rose-colored glasses.
Right.
But, the thing that does bite my buns here a little bit, Drew, is Intel's getting $8.5 billion in government funding to restart its manufacturing in the US.
Yes.
And it's necessary, and I agree it's probably vital from a geopolitical situation, right? And mm-hmm. let's leave that aside. But I'd also point out that the Intel shareholders got a lot of value from that offshoring.
Oh, right? Yes. And executives.
They got money, they got paid, and now they're going to get the same. They're going to get it again from onshoring without paying for it at all. So I'm a little bit, you know, funny how the shareholders always win.
Funny,
but
yes.
There you go. So, but you know, sometimes I just feel like, you know, that's the way that it works, but it does feel a little bit unfair that Intel's suddenly getting, you know, and Intel shareholders are getting a lot of money, and it is in the social good and it is all of that stuff. But there's two sides to this, and it sometimes just gets stuck in. And that's why I'm a little cynical and I keep saying Intel gets free money when I talk about this topic.
It is galling that companies that did offshore in the first place are now also getting free money to bring it back onshore. But also, yes, we kind of do need this. So I do also feel my bum is bitten a bit, but I think we're just going to have to take it. I do hope that, first of all, I love the fact that this is a non-binding preliminary memorandum of terms. That is like the least... ironclad language I've ever heard. But I do hope
a lot of press around it. There was a lot of press behind it.
A lot of press behind it.
That suggests that money was spent pushing that message out there.
Yes, but I do hope it includes clawback provisions if at some point Intel walks away from proposed projects for which it's getting government largesse. I do hope that's in there. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I also kind of feel like, you know, top executives should have to wear T-shirts every time, you know, they go on like these financial news shows and stuff saying, wear a T-shirt that says, I love corporate welfare, because that's what this is. They love to talk about capitalism and the free market, but they will also take that corporate welfare when it's handed out, and they should be made to say that publicly.
And not complain about taxes.
Yeah, definitely not complain about taxes. Shut your mouth.
It should be like a yes. Sign here to say you'll stop complaining about taxes for at least 5 years if you take this money. It's pretty funny. But I mean, it's absolutely necessary in the current situation. We do need to have these things here. I agree. But I'd just like to see, you know, there is two sides to this. Society is paying a very high price to reverse the changes, but it was a fair risk at the same time. That is, we did hope that globalism was going to be able to improve the world. You know,
I mean, we have helped build global economy. We have helped raise people out of poverty. So yes, that's a good. There's always good and bads of all of this. So yes, we are grappling with
that. One thing that I am very hopeful for is that if we go onshore, in theory, onshoring into the Europe and to the USA and moving these factories, because Europe is doing this as well, by the way, and not to, you know, support any particular one government, and lots of other countries are pushing to get investment in their local economies. Are we going to see productivity benefits? So if you place these factories in first world countries, is there an advantage? Can they outcompete? Is there some way in which we see the first world companies innovate faster, deliver new products faster? Are they more efficient? Are they whatever?
So, right, higher quality, more efficient, and so on, yeah.
Yeah. Or is this just a, this is, you know, farm labor type work and anyone could do it and just having it for the cheapest possible price is where it should be? Is it, you know, I'd be interested to watch that play out in the years ahead.
Yes, I'm sure we'll be talking about it. All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, G-Core. They are introducing FastEdge. This is a new product in low-latency edge computing for serverless app deployment built on WebAssembly. With FastEdge, your code runs closer to your users than ever before, leveraging a global CDN of over 160 data centers to ensure lightning-fast performance. You can deploy your applications in minutes, code in your preferred language, and enjoy a secure, serverless environment that scales automatically. It's simpler and faster than ever to build and deploy AI applications, image optimization services, and personalized web experiences. Join the FastEdge beta today and transform how your applications are delivered. Visit gcore.com/packetpushers to learn more. With FastEdge, the future of edge computing is here, and it's ready to power your next big idea. That's gcore.com/packetpushers. All right, this is our second story on more money for chipmakers. South Korean chipmaker SK Hynix is dangling a $4 billion offer to the U.S. state of Indiana to build a chip packaging facility in that state. News reports say operations could begin in 2028, but SK Hynix's board hasn't finalized the deal yet.
Yeah, so SK Hynix doesn't make CPUs, but they make a lot of other chips.
Yeah, I guess they're best known for high bandwidth memory chips, which they make for NVIDIA. So it's
And DRAMs. Yeah.
NVIDIA supplier, SK Hynix. Like, you have to get NVIDIA in the headline these days.
You made a note here in the show notes that this was an AI-generated article. So maybe that's what the AI picks out as the highlight.
Could be.
You know, like, okay. So again, geopolitically, South Korea is like Taiwan, right next door to a belligerent nation-state actor. And as part of a political push by the U.S., since both South Korea and Taiwan rely on the USA for military protection, it's a key ally for those things. And that's exactly what a government does and should do, by the way. Don't get me wrong. They should push to say, well, if you're, you know, we're spending millions to, you know, be your ally and put military forces in your country and so forth and so on, maybe a little quid pro quo is called for.
Yes.
The angle that's not discussed here or ever mentioned here is that this will likely lead to higher prices. And there are reasons why manufacturers don't put factories in the USA or Europe. Labor, land, local authorities are not substantive against. So one of the things that I'm learning is that in Taiwan, especially, and also in South Korea, is if these big companies come along and say, we need to build a plant somewhere, the local authorities fall over backwards to help them out, right? They find ways to help them acquire land. They give them priority access to water. They build universities. They, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't mean to say they're subservient, but they're supportive in every dimension possible. Whereas in, you know, certainly in, you know, parts of the first world, local authorities see once you're there, they've got you. and you're right. They don't stay subservient, if you like. They once they've got you there, they figure they've got you stuck. And so I've heard read many articles where people say we're putting the fact like this plant that was going on for TSMC in Arizona. Mm-hmm. You get a constant stream of articles there where the local authorities, like the unions, act up. The local authorities say you're not following our rules, or you know, you can't put the road there. And they're saying, but that's what you know, all this sort of stuff.
Right.
Whereas in South Korea and Taiwan, they say they cleat the board. And so there are reasons why people don't put factories in the USA or Europe. And this is why. These are some of the issues.
Sure, we have higher labor standards. We have higher cost of living. We have things like environmental mm-hmm. reviews. You may run into local groups who, for good reasons, don't want a factory in that location and so on. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are costs associated with home shoring.
So I just wonder, you know, will we see higher prices on these goods if factories start, you know, being set up in first world countries and they're not as productive as the offshore ones? So we'll see. We'll see. You know, the same applies to the Intel one we just talked about a minute ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, can we handle higher prices on our silicon as a result? Because that's why we moved it offshore, is to get cheaper products.
Yep.
So.
All right, two more stories before we wrap. Andy Bechtolsheim, he's the co-founder of Arista Networks, is going to pay nearly $1 million fine to the SEC to settle charges of insider trading. The charges stem back to 2019 when the SEC alleges Bechtolsheim used insider knowledge of an impending acquisition of Acacia Communications by Cisco to buy options on Acacia before the acquisition news went public. In addition to the civil fine, Bechtolsheim is barred from serving as an officer or director of a public company for 5 years.
Yeah, so obviously Andy Bechtolsheim is a well-known figure in Silicon Valley. He was one of the founders at Sun Microsystems from nothing. And he has gone on to become an investor in many companies. And the one that most AI seem to have picked up on, of course, he was the chief architect at Arista. I don't think he still is he?
I just went and looked at the Arista website and he still is listed as chief architect. I looked to see if there was a press release saying that maybe he wouldn't be anymore because he's not allowed to be an officer of a public company. Maybe they're making a legal argument that chief architect isn't an officer, but I don't know. For the moment, he's on the website.
maybe it takes a while to catch up.
Yeah.
I think this is something that happens in Silicon Valley all the time. It's a very insular, small community, especially at the sort of levels that Andy Bechtolsheim, he's investing in all sorts of startups and is in the information flow for all sorts of takeovers and stuff like that.
And probably just knows a million people.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this goes on behind the scenes more than we know. It's not so much that he did it here. I get the sense here that he told somebody and then somebody went off to the side and invested on the back of him making a comment and the SEC got wind of it. Now, it's possible that he is or is not, you know, directly a party to this transaction, but notwithstanding, the SEC has decided to go after him one way or the other. And you would assume, I think the settlement did not place guilt, or there wasn't a conviction as such, was it?
It's a civil settlement, so not criminal.
Yeah.
Yes. So the amount, it's under $1 million, but it's double the profit he made from this transaction.
Yeah, I don't think he made the profit. When I read the SEC report, it was actually somebody else was involved and they made the money.
I think he used an account to put the to make the options. He used somebody else's account to make the options, but he profited from the transaction. I think the SEC's clear about that.
Right. Yeah. So there you go. So it was deliberate, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It seems like it. It does seem like it. According to the SEC, it was deliberate.
Yeah. I would put it to you that there's a lot of wealth wandering around in Silicon Valley on the basis of something similar, and that this is a fairly common practice.
I would not be surprised. Yes.
I would not be surprised. Yes. So just be aware of that. Some people are rich just because they're in the right place at the right time, not because of any talent or particular skill.
Well, I think we could say that Mr. Bechtolsheim does have some talent, but he also has connections that he can profit from.
I didn't mean to imply that. What I'm saying is that people in Silicon Valley as a whole.
Gotcha.
But there's no question that Andy Bechtolsheim, you know, made his money the hard way, building Sun Microsystems and so forth.
And then Arista, for sure. All right, our last story. There are serious vulnerabilities in F5's Big IP and ConnectWise that are being exploited by a Chinese hacking group, which is then reselling access to exploited devices to the Chinese government. That's according to research from Mandiant, which says it has, quote, moderate confidence, end quote, about its identification of the hacking group. Targets include UK government agencies and US defense contractors. The F5 vulnerability, which allows a remote attacker to execute commands as root in the Big IP OS, was disclosed in October of 2023 and had a high CV risk score. The ConnectWise Screen Connect vulnerability has a risk score of 10, perfect 10.
I'm not sure who's using ConnectWise. Is this, didn't we see something on this a while ago?
We reported on the vulnerabilities when they came up, in part because the risk rating was so high, but they are being actively exploited. So that's why this story is surfacing again.
Yeah, I don't know too much about ConnectWise. I don't know who they are or what they do, if it's a rebadge or something.
Yeah.
But I do know that F5's definitely been struggling with maintaining security in their big IP appliances for a while. We've seen a string of vulnerabilities over the last, I want to say, 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're trying to pitch themselves now as a security company, but like other major vendors, it seems to be a lot more talk and a lot less deliverable, perhaps. So, not particularly surprising, but maybe if you've got any of these products, maybe go out there and start doing the checks if you haven't already is probably the thing to take away.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mandiant says it's seen evidence that the hacking group, after compromising the vulnerable systems, is installing backdoors and then patching the system so it doesn't show up as vulnerable.
They talk about it's written in C, runs on Linux, and puts Golang-based backdoors and then allows miscreants to get in via reverse SSH cells and then connect to a C2 infrastructure. So they become permanently compromised. As you say, they pull up the ladder after they're done.
Yes.
And so they can then use that to launch further future attacks. And that may be to pivot internally if they identify you as a target. And it's a nation state attacker. They're specifically targeting in the release here that it's China. So if you're a company which is in the crosshairs of China, then you probably want to be double extra scared.
You definitely do your double extra checking, and Mandiant in the report does have remediation and hardening guidelines. I also think it's interesting to note that the further specialization in cyber criminals, where there are access brokers who do the breaking in and then they will sell that entry to other entities. So that's, wow, what a development. Interesting times we live in.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, that does the news portion of the show. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Niall. We're going to learn about their approach to network as a service. That's coming right up. Today on the Tech Bytes podcast, we talk with network as a service provider, Niall. Niall aims to streamline network deployment and operations by providing a complete network service. That means it performs the site survey, it provides the switches and access points, it brings the gear on-prem, it deploys it, and then it provides ongoing monitoring and optimization. The company also integrates things like zero trust and micro-segmentation capabilities. So today we're going to dig into Niall's approach, we're going to explore how it differentiates from traditional networking solutions, and touch on some forthcoming announcements. My guest is Austin Hawthorne. He is VP Worldwide Solution Architects at Niall. Austin, welcome to the podcast. So, you know, I gave that quick overview of Niall in the intro, but let's dig in a little more about how Niall operates, what it provides.
Yeah, absolutely true. To dig in a little bit more about what Niall is, you know, we kind of talk a bit about network as a service, but I want to break that apart a little bit, because what the market has come to know as network as a service isn't what they likely expect from anything labeled as a service. Mm-hmm. If we think of anything labeled as a service, we think about IaaS and PaaS from the cloud providers, the storage compute, you know, providers that are in the cloud like Amazon, GCP, Azure, you know, what have you. We think about SaaS vendors like, you know, Salesforce or Office 365. And if you think about those technologies, I fundamentally believe that's what customers come to expect from anything labeled as a service. The outcomes that they drive are they basically get technology, storage, compute, applications, you know, whatever it might be, that they're able to consume at the pace of their business without having to incur all the cost and complexities of that technology stack. And what's most important about, if we think about that cloud analogy, is the technology stack that those providers use to deliver that technology to those customers is not the traditional products and applications that those customers were actually building, buying, and operating themselves. They had to innovate from the ground up to get rid of all of the complexities, to build in security, to build in agility, to build in the ability to allow them to update it as quickly as they needed to update it, to ensure that, you know, that network, that technology stack was always able to meet the customer's needs at the pace of the customer's business. The challenge in this marketplace is customers are looking for other areas of the IT stack to get those same type of outcomes. And what they've come to learn or expect from the industry as it relates to NAS is that it's just a packaging exercise. It's not like what they hear from, you know, IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS. It's more of, hey, here's the traditional technology wrapped up, you know, with traditional day zero, day one, day two services wrapped up into a financial lease that turns it into a monthly payment. That's just more of the same, because somebody still needs to configure it, design it, architect it, operationalize it, patch it, tune it,
right,
et cetera. It still has all of those traditional complexities. We just moved it from one place to a different place. And Over the last three decades, we've tried that, and it doesn't deliver networking, you know, that, you know, keeps pace with the customer's business.
Yeah, so let's dig into that, because so when I think of as a service, I think of generally doing something in the cloud, and often there is no hardware, no on-prem component, but Nile is doing both. It's a cloud model, but there is also on-prem equipment. There's switches, there's APs and so on that you deliver, but it's operated in the cloud by Nile.
That is correct. I mean, it's essentially like a hybrid cloud model. You know, I like using a lot of analogies to what customers know because, you know, again, what they've been told about NAS isn't necessarily what they should expect from anything called NAS. So if you think about hybrid cloud is I've got some on-prem components, I've got a cloud component, mm-hmm. and I've got a vertically integrated stack between that cloud component and that on-prem component. Right. And ultimately, what that cloud stack does, that hybrid cloud component does, is we eliminate the complexities. We, you know, build in lifecycle operations with a lot of AI automation. And we'll talk more about that as we go through the podcast to essentially deliver that technology stack. In our case, it's on-prem networking, you know, the LAN edge side of the house that enables a customer to have networking that works for them at the pace of their business with all the things they expect to be built in there, like security, for example, that they've had a hard time consuming in the past without worrying about all the burden and the costs, et cetera. They just get networking that they can consume.
Yeah, so let's talk about how this is different from other solutions. I think one way it is, you're not just like letting the customer set up any old equipment and then you run it. Nile has actually built out purpose built equipment for this approach.
We've had to build out our own equipment because if I try to take anybody else's switch or AP or router or visibility solution or automation solution or NAC solution off the shelf, I would actually have to deal with all that complexity. Mm-hmm. And you got to dig into this. There's a lot of nuance to it, but I think your audience would know when we talk about complexity, things that go into, you know, config and getting the golden config and maintaining the golden config. When we think about patch management and bug scrubs and upgrades, when we think about uptime and availability, when we think about the cost of acquiring technology, refreshing, upgrading, scaling technology, when we think about securing that technology, all of that is complexity that customers have to deal with. And I personally would have to deal with that if I just try to take a piece of hardware off the shelf from another vendor and try to wrap automation around it. Our customers, the world, is trying to do that today. They're trying to take something that is complex, like automation, and trying to wrap it around, you know, the complex networking stack to try to solve, you know, the problems that are underneath. What we've done is said, listen, we can't just continue to wrap cost complexity around cost complexity. We first have to actually solve the underlying source of the issues, the complexity. You know, what if we can get rid of the golden config? What if we can get rid of the config mistakes that happen in a CLI? What if we can get rid of some of the architectural challenges that happen with layer two?
Okay, so I get what you're saying. Can you sort of help me understand then the boundaries where how is Nile operating the network for me? What do I as a network engineer do? How do you split those responsibilities if we're talking about sort of this cloud model where you're managing a network from the cloud?
Yeah, and good question, Drew. And I want to keep on kind of referencing back to, you know, something customers, you know, likely know, and that's, you know, that IaaS or PaaS type model. Mm-hmm. Essentially what Nile's doing is delivering that co-managed model for on-prem networking. So as I mentioned earlier, it's a cloud native stack, much like, you know, that storage compute that Amazon is providing, where we get to, enable lifecycle management at scale, you know, being able to roll out patches, upgrades, tuning, optimizations at scale to all of our customers with minimal to no impact in customer environments, much like you would expect from anything that's labeled cloud. That's the innovation that we've built behind the scenes, and that's what a lot of the AI automation, you know, that we're talking about lately goes on behind the scenes. Now, once I deliver that networking stack to a customer, think of it as a networking instance. I then hand the keys to the customer, much like they take, you know, the keys from that EC2 instance, mm-hmm. to do what they need to with that networking stack. This is the customer's network without all of the burden. So if the once I, you know, get this network instance up and running in a customer environment, that hybrid cloud model we touched on a couple of times, now in the cloud portal, the customer's tenant, they now have the ability to do what they want to with that networking stack, being able to set up the subnets, the segmentation, the SSIDs, the integration into their ITSM systems, alerting systems, ticketing systems, those type of things. It's their network, right? Just without all of that burden.
Okay, so then what is it that Nile's doing for me on the management or operation side? You mentioned things like OS upgrades.
Yeah, it's really making sure that that networking stack is always up to date and able to and scaled and secure to ensure that it's meeting the customer's needs. you know, ultimately, we fundamentally believe that a lot of customer environments, you know, they're behind on patches, they're behind on upgrades, they're behind on refreshes, they're behind on optimizations. And there's too much time that's spent doing all of those functions, even though they're not done as often as a customer likely would want them. And there's too many issues that are due to those not keeping up to date on those. There's too much time being spent on, is my config correct, and managing golden configs and patch management. All of that goes away, right? Ultimately, this network stack is put into a customer environment. It's deployed in a high capacity, highly resilient type of model. It's the best capable APs and switches and visibility that's available on the market today, that a customer can just consume without all that burden I mentioned. And we back that up with three SLAs. All the automation that we've done behind the scenes and the architecture that we've put in place, we back that up with three meaningful SLAs around that guarantee performance, around capacity, availability, and coverage. And that gives the customer the reassurance that this network is ready to meet their needs, and now they can do what they need to with it.
Okay, so what happens, for example, if, you know, Nile has come out, built the network, it's up and running, and my end users are going around day to day, and then someone says, hey, you know, my laptop can't connect to the Wi-Fi. What happens to that complaint? Where does it go? Is it something that I solve? Is it something that Nile solves?
That's a great question, Drew. And I'm going to take a step back before I answer that question directly. The first thing to understand is if the customer has a network built, operated, maintained by Nile with all the architectural advantages that I've built in, fundamentally, the network issues, the large source of the network issues, config issues, known bugs that were fixed 2 years ago at another customer that just wasn't patched in my environment, topology change issues due to spanning tree and loops and broadcast, all those issues go away. So our customers are realizing up to 100% reduction in network-related tickets in their environment, which means users are realizing less issues. Now, the next thing that comes up is, okay, what if the issue isn't the network? What if the issue is something outside the network? The visibility that's built into the Nile service block that customers do not have to configure, maintain, they can just consume this visibility, is proactive visibility into where the problem might be, even if it's not in the Nile network. Whether it's with the network services, the applications, the connectivity, they have visibility to know when those issues are happening without waiting for a user to call in a ticket, which means that the remaining tickets, they detect quicker and resolve quicker without waiting for a user to call in a trouble ticket. The last bucket falls into the question you asked. The remaining issues that are left that can't be fundamentally eliminated or proactively detected and resolved, that's when the user, you know, is going to call in a trouble ticket. We want to even enable and support that in a better fashion than most customers realize today. Part of that is some user self-service. There is a period of time that users experience an issue and go through some level of frustration before they get frustrated enough to call the help desk. What if we gave them a self-service portal, the users that use the network, that allow them to see in a very non-techie sort of way whether or not their connectivity is good enough, video grade, you know, et cetera, to give them some reassurances as whether or not the network's good or not, and if there is an issue. And if there is an issue still that they're feeling, the ability to click and open up a ticket with the help desk. This way we can arm the help desk with the information they need to know without asking a bunch of frustrating questions to a non-tech savvy user, so they know where to start hunting for to track down that issue.
Can you give me the sense of the visibility that I would get through the Nile portal if I'm the network engineer sort of in charge of this network?
Yeah, so essentially the IT admin, the network engineer, et cetera, is going to see every user and device that's connected to the network, all the relevant stats that they're going to need to troubleshoot any kind of connectivity issues, whether it be authentication issues, association issues, DHCP issues, could be layer one issues, you know, signal noise ratio, retry rates, could be roaming issues, could be service discovery issues. All of that visibility is literally one click away with inside the Nile portal. That's all from a reactive state. From a proactive state, they have visibility into the availability and the performance of network services like DHCP, DNS, Radius. They have visibility from visibility into the availability and performance of the connectivity, the internet connectivity, all the way through to the applications that the users are using in their environment. Is the CRM available? Is the point of sale system available? Is it responding well, or is it slow? All of that proactive visibility, we're running synthetic checks constantly and providing alerting and visibility to those network engineers and IT admins to let them know where those issues are.
Okay, so we mentioned in the intro that you've got some announcements coming up. Do you want to get into those?
Yeah, some big announcements. And, you know, it's big announcements for us to project out to the market and the market to hear and see. But frankly, it's announcements that about technology we've already had behind the scenes. I mentioned a couple of times, Drew, that we had to build a cloud native stack to deliver these types of outcomes to our customers. To build that, we had to first eliminate a large source of the issues. But once we had a cleaner slate and a common data structure, then we built in a lot of telemetry and automation on top of that telemetry to be able to detect and resolve issues without a human getting involved, even on our side, to be able to deliver those predictable outcomes at scale to all of our customers, to be able to deliver against those SLAs. It's that automation, that telemetry, that instrumentation, that common data structure, what we can learn from that, what we can infer from that, and how we can automatically use that information to detect issues and resolve issues without even a NOC engineer on my side getting involved, thus reducing or eliminating productivity issues or availability issues on the customer side of the network. It's that automation, that AI, and that architecture that we're bringing to the forefront. Frankly, Drew, we weren't talking a lot about that before. We were talking a lot about the service and the outcomes it drives and, hey, don't really worry about what's going on behind the scenes. We built this architecture. It's all about the outcomes in the service. But what we found is that customers absolutely care about what's going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. Right?
and this launch is all about, let's show you what's actually going on behind the scenes, the architecture we built in all of its glory to get customers to realize how cloud native networking should actually be done.
So you mentioned the magic word of AI. What does that mean in the Nile context for your backend operations?
So there's, you know, we're doing a lot of streaming analytics, bulk analytics. We're doing a little bit of, you know, learning, you know, behind the scenes to be able to determine, you know, are there certain aspects in the environment that are triggers of something about to fail? We don't wait for it to fail, but can we identify things that are likely causing some performance issues in the environment, likely, you know, indicators of something starting to degrade, starting to fail, you know, et cetera. It's those, all of that is streaming telemetry as well as bulk telemetry that we're pulling in. And running
this is all pulling up into some kind of cloud data lake, I'm assuming, because of this hybrid cloud model. And you can gather all that data and then start doing analytics against it, trying to do things like predictive analytics and so on.
Absolutely. And that's one of the fundamental reasons we had to build this from the ground up, Drew, because if we just try to pull in or try to build AI and automation on top of disparate systems with disparate data structures, with different code versions and all this other stuff, it's an impossible game to play. Right. But if we build this from the ground up to have a common data structure feeding into a common data lake, right, and all of our customers are running a common hardware and software stack and a common architecture, their SSIDs, their subnets and everything else absolutely will be different. But the underlying architecture itself is a common data structure feeding into this. It allows us to actually be more scalable and more effective at our AI and automation efforts.
Yeah, I think, you know, engineers on their own who are trying to engage with network automation and maybe even network orchestration are realizing what an issue this whole, what sounds so simple, a data model is when you're talking about disparate systems, trying to get these systems to sort of represent common data elements in the same way is actually a really hard issue.
It's totally hard. I mean, we have a slide and I can't put it on this podcast, but as you can imagine, if you think about the different systems that go into quote unquote networking, right? At least the piece of the networking that I'm looking at today, I would have to pull in, you know, into a data store feeds from not just the APs and the access switches and the distribution switches and the routers and the firewalls and the visibility solutions and the NAC solutions and the network management solutions and the config management, patch management, you know, all these different pieces and parts that are from multitude of different vendors that are running a multitude of different software versions. If one little thing changes, one little thing, One patch gets updated for this one particular component of this, and if something in that data structure changes, I've got to start over. Uh-huh. Something breaks, right? And that's what I talked about earlier in the podcast, Drew, about, you know, today's automation, at least as it relates to networking, I'm adding cost complexity on top of cost complexity, right? I'm trying to find a needle in a stack of needles. And if one person makes one little change, you know, my problem gets, you know, that much more difficult to try to solve.
So I understand you've got an event coming up this April where you will sort of pull the covers off what's going on in the back end with this AI capability, yes?
Absolutely. So April 16th is the date. If your listeners want to go to insights.nilesecure.com/broadcast, they'll be able to sign up for this event. And we're going to be doing not only double-clicking on everything I kind of teased out here to what's going on behind the scenes, the multiple systems we have behind the scenes, a little bit more about this data structure, but even examples of this AI and automation in motion. Right. And what, you know, we're going to probably give 5 or 6 or 7 different examples of what this really means to our customers, what it means to the end users, what it means to the as-built network, and why it matters. So they'll get, true exposure into all of that.
All right. One more time. That's insights.nilesecure.com/broadcast, April 16th. Will there be also a replay if I can't make it to the 16th event?
I'm pretty sure we'll be recording it and people will be able to sign up for it. Yep.
All right, Austin, well, we ran out of time, but hopefully we whet some folks' appetites about Nile to find out more about the company. If you are interested, you can go to nilesecure.com or again, sign up for that April 16th live event, insights.nilesecure.com/broadcast. But that is our time for today. So thank you, Austin, for joining us. And thanks to Nile for being a Packet Pusher sponsor. Most importantly, thank you for listening. Packet Pushers has a wealth of free podcasts and blogs aimed at your professional development. You can find them all at packetpushers.net or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join our free Slack community. That's at packetpushers.net/community. And if you're on the job market or you have a position you're looking to fill, check out our new job board at jobs.packetpushers.net. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.